comes to Kingston real estate, local experience matters. Kim Purcell is an award-winning realtor born and raised in Kingston with over a decade of experience and 100 five-star reviews. If you want honest advice and results you can trust, choose Kim. Visit kimpurcell.ca today for more information.
Hello and welcome to The Corridor here on CFRC 101.9 FM in Kingston, Ontario, and podcasting on Spotify and Apple Music. I'm Dinah Jansen, and with me is CFRC Local Journalism Initiative news producer Jesse Bell. This regional news program features news from Kingston and area provided by local and regional journalists through the support of the Local Journalism Initiative and the Community Radio Fund of Canada. Welcome and enjoy. Hello and welcome to The Corridor, brought to you by Realtor Kim Purcell of Sutton Group Masters Realty. Connect with Kim today to find a new home tomorrow via kimpurcell.ca. I'm Dinah Jansen, and with me is CFRC's Local Journalism Initiative producer Jesse Bell. Our first story is from CFRC's Local Journalism Initiative reporter Christina Laurie, covering the national debut of a film that has deep ties to Kingston.
Hello, I'm Christina Laurie, Local Journalism Initiative reporter for CFRC 101.9 FM in Kingston, Ontario. Coming up are some of the top news stories in Kingston and the Islands. You can listen to CFRC's news programs Today in YGK and Kingston Currents on Mondays, Tuesdays, and Wednesdays at 5 p.m. or subscribe to our podcasts on Spotify and Apple Music. If you have any Kingston news tips you'd like to share, you can reach me at news@cfrc.ca.
A Canadian sci-fi thriller filmed entirely in Kingston is reaching audiences across the country. A milestone moment for the city's film industry and a sign of what local production can achieve. Den Mother Crimson premiered nationally on Canadian broadcaster Hollywood Suite on January 27th. The film was shot end-to-end in Kingston by local production company Branded to Film and marks the first locally produced feature at this scale to receive a nationwide broadcast release. The project first debuted at the Kingston Canadian Film Festival in 2023 before gaining international attention as an official selection at the Frontiers Buyers Market at the Cannes Marché de Film. Writer and Branded to Film co-founder Jay Jolly spoke with CFRC about the company's first large-scale production and what it proved possible.
Our whole thing was to build Kingston's first long-form narrative production house. And we needed that first movie from a local production house. So our goal was, can we do that first $1 million end-to-end production? And our benchmark was, A, of course, we wanted to make a fun story and a quality story that, you know, could appeal to a global audience and compete at that kind of level. But really, the heart of this was, we really wanted to show that, A, it was possible to do an end-to-end production. B, we had a benchmark of hiring 60% locals, and we hit that benchmark. And C, that we could gather enough people around from other parts of the industry. So it was really great. Not only was it the first production at that level end-to-end ever done here, you know, when we saw what it could do, like Hollywood Suites, for instance, who is a partner of our company, who's premiering this on their network. David Kine, the CEO, and one of their board members, Richard Sturzberg, are huge supporters of what we're doing here in Kingston. They see the benefit of Kingston being that new, affordable production hub for especially independent Canadian producers that are increasingly getting priced out of the Greater Toronto area, and just increasing the potential of Ontario to, you know, be able to cater to more, because we were starting to see independent producers like myself starting to leave the province and shoot in other provinces to find more of that, more affordability.
Den Mother Crimson is the feature directorial debut of Cilic Sasanese, a veteran assistant director whose credits include Pacific Rim, Resident Evil, and Hairspray. The film stars Canadian stars Daniel Cash, Anouka Okuma, Sarah Mitich, and Saad Siddiqui, and tells the story of three AI experts enlisted as consultants on a secretive AI project whose consequences soon take a terrifying turn.
The story came from another writer, and it was actually a horror movie, and it was set in a kind of a very different paradigm, which was a psychological kind of more a mental hospital. And we just realized that, you know, a very timely thing. Again, this was like 2022 when we were developing it, and then we we just real, you know, AI was already on people's lips, and we realized that the story could be just shifted just a little bit. And for our needs, we were also looking, you know, a lot that had to do with the script was also making it more of a potboiler, which potboiler means it's like characters in a room with not too many other, it's like one location and creating all the intensity and the drama. And, you know, the subject of AI and the implications and the ethics and morality around it just seemed to lend itself really naturally to, again, this kind of like a speculative fiction of this this facility where the AI that's supposed to take care of this facility all of a sudden goes a bit rogue and you know, what that means and for all of those involved.
While the story unfolds largely within a single location, the impact of the production extends far beyond the screen. The film's success helped demonstrate Kingston's viability as a production hub, with more local films and a studio on the horizon. For Kingston's film community, it represents more than a premiere. It's proof of concept and a turning point.
Hollywood Suites, it's, you know, it's going out on cable and then also through their app and stuff like that. Well, for that, it's just, it'll be a bit more of a spotlight on what we're doing. And again, it sets another benchmark and another first for Kingston and what's possible here. I think what it showed is potential. And now what we're seeing that we've done a second film, and now that we're building a studio, is that we're really getting to what I believe is Kingston will be that next great production center for independent production in Ontario.
Once again, Den Mother Crimson is now available to watch nationally on Canadian broadcaster Hollywood Suite, and Branded to Film doesn't plan on slowing down anytime soon.
So what we're hoping is if you interview me next year at this time, that we've done about three or four movies, maybe one of our own and maybe two or three from somebody else that we're starting to bring here to shoot here instead of other jurisdictions.
For CFRC News, supported by the Local Journalism Initiative, this has been Christina Laurie.
Thank you, Chris. Next is Dinah Jansen with a story from the Local Journalism Initiative reporter for the Brockville Recorder and Times, Keith Dempsey, that covers a special ice rescue training session near Gananoque.
Thank you, Jesse. Residents north of Gananoque may have noticed an increased presence of emergency vehicles and firefighters along the river near Turnaround Road and County Road 32 on February 1st as crews carried out ice water rescue training exercises. The training took place near the CN train overpass involving the Leeds and Thousand Islands Fire Service and was part of ongoing preparedness efforts for cold water and ice-related emergencies. Fire officials said the exercises are designed to ensure firefighters are equipped to respond quickly and safely to incidents involving people or vehicles breaking through ice. Ice water rescues present significant dangers to both victims and responders, making regular training essential. Members of the public were permitted to observe the exercises, but were asked to remain a safe distance away and avoid interfering with operations for safety reasons. Fire officials said continued training helps ensure crews are ready to respond effectively during emergencies and enhances public safety across the region during the winter season. The Leeds and Thousand Islands Fire Service has taken delivery of a new Halmatro Omnishore vehicle and structural shoring kit, enhancing its ability to stabilize vehicles, buildings, and other hazards during emergency incidents. Fire officials say the specialized kit will strengthen the department's rescue and stabilization capabilities, helping crews operate more safely and effectively during complex emergencies. The equipment was purchased with support from 1200 Degrees Ontario, with Jason Carroll, John Blackburn, and Omnishore specialist Ruben Markhook assisting with the procurement, delivery, and training process. The new shoring system allows firefighters quickly to secure unstable vehicles, collapsed structures, and other dangerous scenes, reducing risk to both responders and the public. Officials say the investment will improve response times and outcomes in rescue scenarios, further strengthening emergency preparedness for residents in the township and surrounding communities. Thank you to Keith Dempsey for that story. Now over to Jesse Bell with a story from the LGI reporter for YGK News Owen Fullerton about South Frontenac Council's decision to vote against a proposed high-speed railway.
Thank you, Dinah. The township of South Frontenac has become the first municipality to officially and unanimously vote against being included in a high-speed rail line corridor between Quebec City and Toronto. One of the recently released potential route options that Alto, the Crown Corporation responsible for the rail line, would see the trains corridor passing directly through South Frontenac Township, which landowners and environmentalists in the area have said is an unsuitable plan. South Frontenac's council stood behind those concerns, voting unanimously in favor of a motion to reject Alto's projected Southern Ontario corridor, saying instead that it makes more sense to route a train within the boundaries of the city of Kingston. South Frontenac Township Mayor Ron Vandewall says, well, he worried that Kingston's own mayor, Brian Patterson, would push for support of Alto's southern proposal. The two are aligned. The motion was moved to the top of last Tuesday night's agenda, with mostly negative feedback being heard from constituents who said it would disrupt their rural community and natural environment. The Frontenac Arch Biosphere Network said they too have fielded a bevy of concerns around a potential impact to the UNESCO-protected site. Additionally, Mayor Vandewall says the southern option would limit access to the main roads and break up land for some individuals. Vandewall said that he was told by Kingston's Brian Patterson that unless a corridor would service Kingston with a stop in the area, then they too are not interested in supporting the proposal, and a motion planned to go in front of council at an upcoming meeting will say exactly that. As of now, while Alto's southern option would bring the train's path closer to Kingston, there is no option that would see a stop in Kingston, with stops planned for Ottawa, Peterborough, and Toronto. Currently, people in Kingston seeking rail service can choose between options with Via Rail. However, some services offered in the region by the company have been in jeopardy recently. According to an email sent to a constituent from Lanark Frontenac MP Scott Reed, high-speed rail options will lead to lower Via Rail ridership and inevitably cuts to the service through Kingston and other towns in southeastern Ontario. Alto says the services of Via Rail will be eventually integrated with the high-speed rail line, and the creation of such, quote, offers the opportunity to improve services on these existing railroads so as to better address local needs. The Crown Corporation says of the two options proposed for the corridor, the northern route would provide a more direct trip with lower travel time, but required work in remote and sensitive areas, while the southern option provides more simplified construction and operations. Alto will be in South Frontenac hosting a public information session at the Storrington Lions Club on February 18th. Mayor Vandewall said he told Alto representatives that the information session is, quote, a little late and expects no change in community perspective on the proposal.
And thank you to Owen Fullerton for that story. Now over to the LJR reporter for CJAI-FM, Amherst Island Radio, Ted Evans, with a story about the Napanee Health Unit.
Hi, I'm Ted Evans, local journalism initiative reporter and news director at CJAI, Amherst Island Radio, 101.3 FM in Stella, Ontario. Coming up are some of the top news stories from Loyalist Township. You can hear Amherst Island Radio's news program, North Shore News, on 101.3 Amherst Island Radio or online at cjai.ca. For showtimes throughout the week, check the schedule on our website at cjai.ca.
The Southeast Health Unit office in Napanee will be continuing its lease in a smaller capacity at a lesser rate. Originally, they were going to close at the end of March. The health unit has now agreed to reduce their footprint within the building by approximately 75%. As their lease agreement is based on square footage occupied, this has reduced their rent from approximately $1,825 to $430 for the final 20 months of the agreement term. The town's clerk, Jessica Walters, explains why staff believe this is in the best interest for the community.
In short, the health unit is now, they had initially given us a notice of termination effective March 31st. The budget was presented on the assumption that they would no longer be in there after that date. They have subsequently submitted a request to continue their lease, but on amended terms with a reduced footprint in the building and therefore a reduced cost. Staff believe this is in the best interest of the community because it would let us maintain the vaccine clinics and the fridge for well water testing and any other services they might wish to offer there through that office space.
CAO Matthew Grant explains the reduction in space and why he supports them staying open.
Myself, Mr. Brown, and Ms. Walters met with the public health team. And so it does represent a significantly reduced footprint within the building. It's essentially a room to keep the vaccines, as well as the front reception area. And as a building tenant, it still allows them access to the large meeting space to run vaccine clinics. I'm quite supportive of it. I do know that the public health unit has had some challenges to navigate since they've merged the different units into one single unit. As they're looking to reduce costs wherever they can, this was a way they felt they could do that, while still maintaining service to the community. Generally this results in people not having to travel to Kingston for vaccines. And I think that's where the win is, for residents.
Councillor Bill Martin expressed a concern he had about neighboring communities using the service.
I think we have to do it just to maintain the services to our residents, but it concerns me that we're always asked to pay for a service for other communities, because this is going to be used by more than just Napanee residents. It's going to be, you know, it's Kingston, Frontenac, LNA, Prince Edward County, you know. I'm concerned about that part of it, actually, that we're paying, our taxpayers are paying for a service for other communities. But like I said, I don't want our residents to lose any services either.
Grant noted the benefits and said they wouldn't be paying for other municipalities.
I don't know that we're necessarily paying us for other municipalities. I think the benefit is maintenance of vaccine clinics here, which will primarily be for our residents. I would say the only benefit other municipalities may be getting is that the vaccine supply chain in this immediate area of 41 and the like will come through Napanee. But I don't anticipate that other municipalities will be getting a direct benefit from the use of our space other than that.
Mayor Terry Richardson showed his support for the health unit staying open, but noted a concern as well.
I'm hopeful that our staff aren't going to do any more than what they're doing now. Obviously, the concern is if it's not staffed 5 days a week, there's a possibility there, but I'm sure Mr. Grant and the senior leadership team will be monitoring that fairly closely. So, and it's a little bit refreshing in the fact that the health unit has now realized that it's important to have a brick and mortar type of facility within our community, that you just cannot do it remotely.
For Amherst Island Radio and the Local Journalism Initiative, I'm Ted Evans.
Thank you to Ted Evans for that story. Over to the Local Journalism Initiative reporter for CJPE, Brenda Little, with a story about the County Food Hub.
In 2017, the rural schools of Prince Edward County were reassessed, resulting in closures and amalgamations. The Sophiasburg School was on the chopping block, but local residents said no. They came together with an idea to create a shared commercial kitchen and called it the County Food Hub. It is used by entrepreneurs, community programs, and partnerships with projects ranging from food business incubation to school lunch programs and community meals, all strengthening local food access and economic development. Recipe for Success is a free entrepreneurship training program aimed at helping people turn food ideas into real sustainable businesses. The Food Hub Executive Director, Melissa Tran, tells us more.
So, what's new?
So we are incredibly excited to talk about a program called Recipe for Success. So in the years that we have been here, what we are seeing is people with lots of passion and desire, and they've got a recipe. So if it's their Nona's tomato sauce or their grandma's muffins or whatever it is, they have something they're passionate about making, but they don't necessarily have business experience. And so they come in and they want to make something, but there's a lot of regulations and rules around food and labeling and packaging. And so what this program is a 7-week entrepreneurial training program for anybody who's interested in starting a food business.
And when does that start?
So right now applications are open, and the program itself will start on March 22nd with a welcome event. And then for 7 Mondays after that, we've got, it's 15 total modules we've squished into those 7 days. So we start with Business 101. When do you get an HST number? Because not all food has tax on it. So, you know, when do you need to do that? Should you be incorporated, not incorporated? How do you write a business plan? Because if you want to go to get funding from a bank or community futures or any of those types of programs, you have to have a solid business plan. So we start right with business 101, how to keep your food and your customers safe. We talk about packaging and nutrition labels and regulations that are around that. We talk about being able to get your product ready for retail. How do you get into stores? Working with distributors, looking at your recipes, scaling it up, process efficiencies. And then we also talk about the hospitality side of the food industry, as well as branding, marketing, social media. We live in a very touristy area, so we have a workshop just on culinary tourism in the area. And then we end it with a photographer and a food stylist showing you how to be able to take better pictures of your product, because we live in a world where social media is everything. You have to have a social media account or people aren't going to know about you. Yeah.
That's right.
Yeah.
Did you recently get a grant or some money to help you with this? Or
we did, yes. So it is primarily sponsored through the Agriculture Workforce Equity and Diversity Initiative, which provides funding to organizations to support underrepresented groups that are starting or growing a food business in Canada. So this project is partly funded by the Government of Canada and Ontario under the Sustainable Canadian Agriculture Partnership. And then we've also partnered with the County of Prince Edward Economic Development Office. And so if you haven't dealt with them, they help strengthen local food businesses and all other businesses. They're there to invest in the long-term economic resilience across our community.
You must have a team of people to teach these things.
We do, yeah. So each one of those modules has a different instructor in it. Yeah. So whoever the expert is in that field will come in. So all of these classes are offered in person. Some of them will happen in our kitchen here if it's a food-based class. And then if it's a little bit more just educational or training, then we'll be in one of the town halls. The idea grew over time, and the ideas for the workshops grew over time. We ran a couple focus groups back at the beginning of 2024. Time is starting to run together. Where we brought in people who were in food businesses, and they had talked about things that would have been helpful to them as they were starting. So that inspired some of it. And then I just get a number of people who come in the door and say, you know, I have this idea to make ice cream cakes, or to start some sort of food business. How do I start? So we're hoping if we combine all of this together and we can offer it at no cost, that people will be able to find time in their schedule and interest. And yeah, the first time you're running something, you're never really sure how many people are we going to have 50 people sign up or 5 people? We have room for 15. So we're hoping.
Right.
We're hoping to fill it.
And how do people apply?
So on the County Food Hub website, there is a link that says Recipe for Success, and it's a very simple Google form to fill out.
Fantastic. Is there anything else you'd like to add?
I just looked at, so the cutoff date for applying is February 13th. So it's coming up. And then our team will look at the applications and we'll let everybody know by February 20th. So there's lots of time to make arrangements for the classes.
For the Local Journalism Initiative, frequencynews.ca and CJPE County FM, I'm Brenda Little.
Thank you to Brenda Little for that story. Over to the Local Journalism Initiative reporter for CFWN, Dan Jones, with a story about Black History Month celebrations in Northumberland County.
Hi, I'm Dan Jones with CFWN in Cobourg, Ontario. Black History Month is in full swing in Northumberland County with the raising of the Pan-African flag in Cobourg and Port Hope. But for Angela Grogan, this month is about learning more of the rich contributions Black people have made to the area.
For me, Black history is a time of reflection, learning and recognition of a history that I knew little about. It is a time to honor the history, contributions, resilience, and leadership of Black communities across Canada, and also right here in our local community of Northumberland County.
So how do you honor that?
We honor it in many ways. It began in 2024 when I realized there was no official recognition of Black History Month in our county, and I wouldn't even go, and it might be anywhere east of here. I started off by petitioning to the municipality of Port Hope to proclaim February as Black History Month in our municipality and to raise the Pan-African flag as a symbol. Then in 2025, I extended that same petition to the county of Northumberland and again this year to the county, to the town of Cobourg. I must say, even though it might sound commendable, I don't think it should have been based on advocacy for this recognition to be given, because we have a history of early settlers in our county that has been either erased or buried in the archives. And I am not sure if our listeners are following me on my 28-day series. I take pride in knowing that I dedicated almost close to 6 months in researching Northumberland County's history that has excluded Black people.
Angela, give us some of the history that you've researched about prominent Black people in the county.
If you look at my first series on day one, I looked at the pioneer people and the first settlers that came to Northumberland via the railroad, freedom fighters. They came with a number of different reasons, just like how other immigrants have come to Canada. So if we look at day one, I'm pulling it up because that's who I am, pulling back up my notes. If we look at day one, we will see that there's a number of prominent families who came here and are still living here. And their names could sometimes be recognized by people in the community. And I'm not saying they're directly related, but I'm just saying that, yes, we see that the history of Black history is rooted in Northumberland County. And I use that also as the theme of my Black History Month presentations. So when we look at local historical research documents, you had families such as the Huffmans, Longsberry, and Hornback families living in and around Cobourg, Port Hope, Bewdley, and Hamilton townships. These families were not just passing through, they were rooted. It is stated that the Longsberry family settled near Harwood, and some Black settlers in the northern, and some of them were farmers. The Huffmans live in the Hamilton Township, and some of their family members are buried in Bewdley Union Cemetery. The records also list early Black individuals connected to Port Hope, including Edward Berry. These facts are real, and they're woven into our shared history. And I take great pride in this one because I moved to Port Hope about 13 years ago, and one of my good friends always teased me, you would never be long because you would need 3 generations of family buried in the local cemetery. So when I was doing my research and I discovered all this, I thought, here you are, I do belong, even though they're not my family.
How does it make you feel, though, that this is now getting out?
Well, I think it's now getting out because I took the deliberate, I won't say ownership because I don't own it, but I use some of the experiences that I encountered in the county and in my town to investigate, to find out why is it that people believe that Black people doesn't, or our new immigrants, or new migrants coming in from Toronto and other cities to Port Hope and to Northumberland County. Because if you look back, the records also stated that there was a William Waddell, and he established a barbershop in Cobourg called the Cobourg Bath before 1848. And it described him as a Black entrepreneur. Then they give detailed records of ownership of the Albert House and the concert rooms on King Street East in Port Hope. So when history is not fully told, it's shaped who is seen as belonging and why their stories do not matter.
Reporting for CFWN and the Local Journalism Initiative, I'm Dan Jones.
And thank you to Dan Jones for that story. Next up on The Corridor, supported by local realtor Kim Purcell at kimpurcell.ca, is Jesse Bell with CFRC's Environment Canada weather forecast for the Kingston region.
This is your Environment Canada weather report for the Kingston region. Thursday, February 12th, daytime high of minus 2, actually feeling slightly warmer at minus 1 with sunny conditions, dropping down to minus 16 overnight. Friday, February 13th, daytime high of minus 5, actually feeling right around 0 in the sunshine. Saturday, February 14th, Valentine's Day, daytime high of minus 2, feeling closer to minus 11, so if you've got somebody to snuggle up with, keep them warm. Sunday, February 15th, daytime high of minus 3, going to feel closer to minus 11. And then starting off next week, Monday, February 16th, daytime high of 1, but we've got cloudy and cool conditions. It's actually going to feel closer to minus 6 when all is said and done.
And that's a wrap for this week's edition of The Corridor, supported by the Local Journalism Initiative and the Community Radio Fund of Canada. Don't forget to visit CFRC.ca for the latest in local and regional news headlines, concert and events listings, and more. You can also follow CFRC on Facebook and Instagram at CFRC Music and on Twitter X at CFRC. You can support CFRC and its independent news programming by donating via CFRC.ca. We'll be back next week with more in local and regional news. Thank you for joining us. Thank you for listening to this podcast produced at CFRC 101.9 FM at Queen's University in Kingston, Ontario, situated on the traditional territories of the Anishinaabe and Haudenosaunee peoples, and brought to you by the generous support of Smith Engineering.
When it comes to Kingston real estate, local experience matters. Kim Purcell is an award-winning realtor born and raised in Kingston with over a decade of experience and 100 five-star reviews. If you want honest advice and results you can trust, choose Kim. Visit kimpurcell.ca today for more information.
Ladies and gentlemen, it is a pleasure to be here in Paris, Roland-Garros, for a Grand Slam action.
The match of the day, Martin Solveig against Bob Sinclair. I could stick around and get along with you. Hello, oh-oh-oh. It doesn't really mean that I'm into you. Hello, oh-oh-oh. You're alright, but I'm your darling to enjoy the party. Don't get too excited, cause that's all you'll get from me. Hey, yeah, I think you're cute.
Hello and welcome to another episode of the Plugged in My Ears podcast. I am your host, Adam Whale. I'm so excited to be here today with my little pookie bear, Jackson Lowe's, on the show.
First time ever.
And that speaking there is Mr. Aiden Peterson, our soccer and girlfriend hater expert. And here we are with Jackson, the Emerald City Seahawks specialist. How excited are you to be on the show, Jackson?
Mildly excited.
That's how we like to keep it here. This is a mild podcast with no hot takes.
No exaggeration
at all. Ever since Sam's been out of here. No, I'm just kidding. Sam and Kyle will be back next week. They're busy this week again, I guess. I don't know. Maybe they're actually in Italy getting some analysis for our show next week. They're not. But yes, we are going to be talking Olympics. We're going to be talking Gavin McKenna. And some team won the Super Bowl or something. I don't really know. That's what we got allegedly, the expert for, allegedly. Right?
Yeah. The most goated team of all time, I will say.
All right, let's hop in with this Gavin McKenna case. It's kind of dated now. Like we are getting this super late. Like, as everyone knows, we record on Tuesdays. This is going to come out on Thursday. But this like happened like last Friday. Like, everyone heard about this.
We're not the first on the scene, that's for sure.
No, this is not breaking news. But Gavin McKenna was in a bit of a bar fight, it seems. And he ended up breaking someone's jaw. They required to shut the guy's jaw, I think, or they had to like restructure it or something. So he was originally being charged with a plethora of things, but I think now he's just facing a misdemeanor, but he still could face up to 20 years in prison if found guilty. For those who don't know, Gavin McKenna is the projected number one overall pick in the NHL draft. It kind of, he was consensus a little while ago, but some other players have been making their case. So he wasn't really consensus number one, but he's definitely a top three pick for sure. Mm-hmm. He was a stud at the World Juniors, and he's currently playing at Penn State University, and he's doing quite well. But this is, we haven't seen something like this in a really long time, especially in the NHL. We've seen this in other sports leagues where sometimes things come out pre-draft and they go downhill. They they tank in the draft rankings. But this is the first time that I can really think of a really big one, other than I guess the closest would be like Logan Mailloux with the Montreal Canadiens a couple years ago. But this is pretty interesting to see, because Gavin McKenna seems like such a mild-mannered, calm guy on the ice. Makes you think what really triggered this. Any thoughts?
Well, I'd first like to say that, you know, it's a good sign every time a young NHL prospect makes the news. But in the case of the Gavin McKenna situation, from the rumor mill online, nothing confirmed, but although the internet never lies, so we can trust this information, allegedly... a drunken person at the bar was hurling insults at his mother, whether she was there or not. And this went on for a while and resulted in McKenna eventually putting an end to it in his own way, in his own manner. So I'm not sure how much of this is true. We'll wait for more of the details to come out. But I think if this is the case, I think some of that action might be justifiable on McKenna's side.
Yeah, because we don't even know if he was intoxicated, because McKenna being underage in the U.S., like, he apparently had a wristband on that said he wasn't supposed to drink. There was, like, I mean, this is, like, all, like, stuff I've just seen on, like, Reddit, and, like, you cannot trust these sources.
Yeah.
But apparently, like, he took off the wristband and, like, was trying to get drinks, and he got super drunk. But I kind of highly doubt that was the case, especially with, so the guy that got hit apparently dropped the civil case against McKenna. And the police determined that there was no intent by McKenna to cause serious bodily harm. And that was part of the reason why that got thrown out. So it does kind of look like a defending his mother's honor, if that's the case, or defending someone's honor. Mm-hmm. It doesn't really seem like Gavin McKenna does not give me insane person vibes. So I think that this is not really going to affect too much. He's expected to not miss a single college hockey game with these things going on.
Yeah.
So I really don't think it's as serious as it's made up to be. But definitely not the thing you probably want to be in the news for, coming up to probably one of the biggest moments of your life.
Yeah.
But, yeah, I don't think that it will have too much of an impact on where he goes in the draft.
Mm-hmm. Would it actually solidify his position of where he goes in the draft? Because I don't believe we haven't seen much of a physical side from McKenna yet.
Yeah.
So if teams that potentially are looking for a more physical skill player, could this actually improve his draft stock?
I have heard NHL teams are looking outside of the box on how they evaluate prospects now. So this could be a new tactic, maybe by like the Vegas Golden Knights or something, you know, like send someone there to, it's like in Happy Gilmore with the guy that's chirping Adam Sandler in the one, or chirping Happy in the one golf. That's what I think, a similar case, maybe, you know?
I mean, as a Blackhawks fan here, I do hope he falls a little bit to us. It would be nice. You can only tank so hard.
The Blackhawks might get the first overall pick. I don't know what you're talking about. Like,
maybe Vancouver's putting in a hard bid, but we'll see.
Yeah. No, but anyways, we're going to move on to the Super Bowl. I love the Super Bowl.
I love the Super Bowl.
I love this year's Super Bowl.
And the Super Bowl was garbage this year. Just gonna come out and say that.
Trash.
The result was amazing. That's all that matters.
Yes. So Jackson is the Emerald City Route Artist's biggest fan. And he is here to give us his take on the Super Bowl. He's been a Seattle Seahawks fan since their last Super Bowl. Connection to Seattle. Likes their jerseys.
Do like their jerseys. Very nice.
But no, he is a diehard, I will say, because he definitely knows their all-time leading rusher.
Huh.
Okay, all right. So the Seattle Seahawks defeated New England Patriots. New England, the schedule Patriots. Drake, the schedule May.
Drake May.
Yeah, okay. We got to bring this back so the listeners can understand what we're talking about. But Seattle did destroy the Seahawks, and it wasn't really close.
It was a defensive masterclass. The defense actually came out and said that they knew a lot of the tells from the offensive line. They knew sort of what they were going to do. So it was almost over before it started.
Yeah, and that's one of the biggest storylines coming out of the Super Bowl was the offensive line of the Patriots being so awful, and specifically Will Campbell, who refused to talk to the media after the Super Bowl. And I don't know if I agree with that. I think Drake May sat there and talked to the media after the Super Bowl, but Will Campbell says no, doesn't sit right with me. I think Will Campbell has a lot of growing up to do. And I know that he said big time that early when he was drafted, he's like, I'm going to die for these guys. He did not die for these guys in the Super Bowl. Seattle ran over Campbell.
Well, yeah, he didn't die for them in the way that he wanted to, but he did die on that field. I think he broke the record for the all-time allowed pressures or sacks in a Super Bowl, so that's not a good stat to have. But I do agree with you, Adam, that although you had a bad game, every player should stand up and face the music post-game in the interview.
Yeah. Jackson, what did you think of Seattle's defense? Who were the studs on defense for you? Like, who you were most impressed by? They had a great defense all season long, but who really stood out in this game?
I feel like you got to go D-line here. I mean, the secondary is amazing, but DeMarcus Lawrence, what a pickup by Seattle right there. Yeah, the D-line just absolutely destroyed. Nuosu got that touchdown, I think, what, third, fourth quarter, something like that.
Yeah.
That really sealed the game. So, yeah, I would say D-line overall, if they could all get the Super Bowl MVP, if it were possible,
yeah,
I would give it to them.
But what a performance from Kenneth Walker, too. I mean, boy, did he play out of his mind. And I saw, like, this video about, like, his dad had never gone to an NFL game until this game because he, like, doesn't like crowds. And what a game to go and have in your when your dad's first game watching you. Like, that's pretty cool. Other Seahawks that had great games, Jason Myers and Michael Dixon, okay? I want to say that
these
guys are my MVPs, I'm not going to lie. The special teams was amazing in the Super Bowl. If there was a high point in the Super Bowl, like, that was unique from other Super Bowls, I think it was the level of special teams from the Seattle Seahawks. The punts were fantastic.
The punts were amazing.
There were, like, two that were down within the five.
Yeah.
And Jason Myers had two touchdowns worth of points for them. So I think it was a really interesting Super Bowl. I personally think this one was a lot more entertaining than last 2 years ago, like the Patriots, or not Patriots, the Chiefs and the Eagles. I thought that Super Bowl was a blowout, kind of done in the first couple quarters. At least this one was, there was kind of the feeling that New England might be able to string something together. They looked really good on that one drive, like the two passes to Mac Hollins.
Yep.
But
you can't sustain that for a game.
No, and that one interception by May was so questionable. Threw a grilled cheese sandwich to the defense, like
pizza up the middle. It was it was embarrassing to see.
No.
But he didn't have a lot of time. So what are you gonna do?
Yeah, and you know the listeners will say that I've been saying this for a while that New England is fraudulent and they aren't as good as, they're a good team, don't get me wrong, but they got a lot of growing up to do. They got a lot of places that they can improve on because they're not going to get as easy of a schedule next year. But I think that we were taking a look at the odds actually post Super Bowl, and the Bills have the best odds in the AFC. So that's promising.
Who's we, Adam? That might have just been you.
That might have been me and Antonio Sousa Diaz. We're taking a look at that. But yeah, no, the Patriots don't even have the best odds to come out of the AFC. Seahawks, again, have the best odds to win the Super Bowl, so looking like a potential repeat. What do you think the odds of them repeating are, Jackson? Like, how confident are you in this team? Like, what do you think about the rest of the league? The NFC is clearly much stronger than the AFC. So is it a team in the NFC that you could see maybe posing a threat to the Seahawks? Or do you think it's going to come out of the AFC?
I'm concerned with the NFC West in particular. You never know how it's going to go, except for the Cardinals, obviously. Terrible. They're probably going to lose their quarterback too, which is interesting. But yeah, it's those three teams in the NFC West, crazy. Caleb Williams and the Bears, who knows? I think I agree the West is a lot stronger. I'd love to see something out of the AFC. I would love to see a Bills-Seahawks Super Bowl. Should have been this year, unfortunately.
That's what I'm saying, yeah. Yeah, no. Or a Bengals-Seahawks. AP is also a Bengals specialist, in addition to soccer and girlfriend hating. So, AP, what do you think of the Cincinnati Bengals? Are they going to have a stellar offseason and make a comeback?
I appreciate the shout-out, Adam. In terms of the Cincinnati Bengals, you never know. You really never know. You have a cheap owner in Mike Brown who's not going to make drastic moves. He's going to go with the safe option. They don't have a scouting team, believe it or not. They have one man named Duke Tobin who makes all the decisions and got lucky on one draft, and that draft was T. Higgins and Joe Burrow, and then took a no-brainer in Ja'Marr Chase in the next year. And then ever since then, every draft pick that we've had so far has either been a bust or at best mid. So I know Mike Brown won't overspend in the offseason, so we won't get any pieces to actually bolster our team, and we can't because both Joe Burrow and Ja'Marr Chase are taking up almost 50% of the cap here. So
yeah.
Unless the defense can somehow turn it around with the pieces they got, add one or two minor pieces, then I don't see the Bengals getting anywhere near a Super Bowl, even the playoffs.
Oh, really?
Well, I think they might be able to kiss the playoffs. I'm not sure about how far we can go in with them.
Because I really don't think the Steelers are going to be as good as they were this year. I think it's going to be Ravens, Bengals. I don't see the Browns doing anything next year.
Yeah.
So I kind of like the Bengals' chances. I feel like they just need one fully healthy year from Joe Burrow to get back to where they were. Because, I mean, they were in the Super Bowl, right? Like, they were close to winning the Super Bowl. That was a good Super Bowl. And I think they've got the pieces. I think that the offensive line, obviously, has been a point of contention for a while now. But this team isn't as far off as people say. I think they're as far off as the Bills are.
I would disagree there, just because I don't watch many Bills games, but I don't hear as many gripes on their offensive line performances as I do on the Bengals, as well as they have a solid defense minus the D-line.
Okay, all right. That's
so I think, in terms, like, I don't know if you guys watched the Cincinnati-Chicago game last year, but Cincinnati made it back with Joe Flacco at the helm. They scored two touchdowns to take the lead, 42-41, 35 seconds left, and they allow a 60-yard bomb from Caleb Williams, three missed tackles, and the Bengals lose the game.
Yeah, I was going to say, we're saying a lot about O-line. Defense, I feel like, isn't Trey Hendrickson coming up on a contract year?
Yeah, I believe he's likely gone before the next season.
Okay, so maybe the Bills are better off than the Bengals, but, you know, it's a wild league. The Patriots, they went 5-12 last year, and then here they are winning the AFC. Out of all the teams that missed the playoffs, is there a team that you guys think could go crazy style and go back to the Super Bowl, or go to their first Super Bowl? I mean, there's some teams out there that I think a lot of people expected to do well this year, did poorly this year, and might be able to bounce back.
I mean, immediately thinking about the Colts right now.
They
started out really hot with Daniel Jones. So we'll see how that goes. Mm-hmm. I don't know what happened with the Bucks. I don't know how they could fix that. I'm not really tapped in on the Bucks at all, but I would say Colts. I'm excited to see what they do next year.
Yeah, no, I think that's a good choice. I think a lot of people are thinking Kansas City if Patrick Mahomes can come back for at least half the season. I don't think so, though. I think the Chiefs are going to miss it again next year, get another draft pick. Like, they're going to get two. I think they're going to get a great draft pick this year.
Probably O-line, maybe, or something along
those
lines.
They'll gear up. I think they'll be back after the little two-year hiatus, and then they'll be back, but I don't know. Chiefs, I would say, are my pick to. I think that they could turn something around. AP, any team stick out to you?
This is going to be a hot take here, but I'm saying the Washington Commanders. If Jaden Daniels can figure out how to throw the ball again, this team could be dangerous.
Yeah, I feel like he was kind of playing injured all throughout this season. Like, I know he was out a couple of weeks, but then he would come back, and it almost seemed like, why are you bringing him back? Like, the team's not doing that well.
Yeah.
They started out okay, but I mean,
that injury against the Seahawks just looked absolutely terrible. Like, I don't know why he was in the game at that point, but that should have been career-ending, so anything from him next season that's remotely good, I'll be pretty surprised.
Yeah, no, and that's a tough division too, because the Eagles, I think, are going to be good again next year. Mm-hmm. The Cowboys can always... I think the Cowboys might be a team that turns it around a bit. Maybe they have a good year. I feel like people say that every year, but franchise tag George Pickens, who is my one of my favorite wide receivers. But they're a solid team that could do some damage. But yeah, no, the NFL season over. We go into that strange period of waiting, which always seems longer than almost any other sport. Like the gap between the end of the NFL season and the start of the season, because I don't really count the preseason because it still feels so far away, even when preseason games are going on. And there's not really any huge name free agents. There's no free agents that I'm really like, oh, I can't. I don't. I wonder where they're gonna go. Like, it's gonna be a pretty sad time between now and the start of the NFL season.
Very quiet, yeah.
Yeah, yeah, no, it is going to be quiet.
You might have to watch baseball or something like that.
I know, yeah, spring training. Teams start spring training Monday. It's already getting back into the swing of things. The Blue Jays made a couple nice offseason additions. Obviously a big loss in Bo Bichette, but they did get a player from the Japanese league, I believe. I don't know his name. And Dylan Cease, who is one of the better pitchers in the NFL. So they've got a nasty rotation going next year. Will they be able to go back to the World Series? You never know. I think as long as you got Vladdy G on that team, you're good for at least a playoff spot. But it'll be definitely a tough hill to climb to get back to where they were last year. Okay, for the last 10 minutes, we're going to talk a little bit about the Winter Olympics because they are in full-on game mode now. Medals have already started to be handed out. Canada not near the top at all at this year's Olympics. Is this a surprise to you guys? Because I feel like Norway was a team that I think they have the most Winter Olympic medals all time. So it's not a surprise that they're up there. But I am surprised with the lack of Canadian medals. AP, do you happen to have the medal count up there?
I do indeed, Adam. Call me Jamie from the Joe Rogan podcast.
Perfect.
I'll give you the top 10.
Okay.
So in first, we have Norway with 12. So 6 gold, 2 silver, 4 bronze. Then we have Germany, Sweden, Switzerland, United States, Austria, Italy, Japan, France. Those are our top 10.
Okay.
And then we are sitting in 14th with 3 medals. 1 silver, 2 bronze.
What was the silver? I think I missed that today.
Speed skating this morning.
Speed skating. Okay, 2 speed skating medals for Canada. They have 1 bronze and 1 silver, and then the bronze is in snowboarding?
The 2 bronze skiing that we have, one of them is, it's in skiing. It's in slope style,
yeah, okay. So I did catch those. I watched the slope style and I watched first speed skating, but I'll have to check up on that second speed skating. It is early, super early in the Olympics. Like, obviously not all the events are through. I know Canada had some figure skating going on this afternoon.
I think they did pretty well in that.
Okay, all right.
They were leading for a while.
And then hockey really should be something that they do well in. But, I mean, we watched a game today, Canada women's against the U.S.
That was
not look good at all. The U.S. blanked Canada 5-0. I was watching Canada versus Switzerland a couple days ago, and I was saying this Canada team doesn't look fantastic. They piled the shots on Switzerland's goalie, but only won 5-0 with 55 shots.
Yeah.
And Switzerland had like 6 shots in the game. Like, they compared that game to Canada versus the Swiss at the last Olympics, and Canada won 12-1.
Yep. And what was the shot count?
Very similar. Okay. Almost identical shot count. So that's concerning to me because I know, like, you can say the Swiss goalie stood on her head. She did play well. I watched the whole game. She played well. But also, I just think Canada's not generating high danger chances against these teams that they're significantly better than. 100%. And now they go and play a team like the U.S. that they're kind of on par with. It wasn't really close the whole time, and the U.S. heavily outshot them.
Heavily. Yeah. It almost felt like we were watching a Canada-Italy game, but from Canada being in Italy's place.
Yeah.
And just watching the game, you could see, I think there's a sequence about 5 minutes in the first period where there were 4 or 5 two-on-one chances for Team USA when Canada struggled to get a unblocked shot on net. And I feel like a lot of it comes from, it almost looked like lack of creativity in the offensive zone.
Mm-hmm.
There was just consistent, like, instead of passing back to find options, it was just drive it into behind the net and then hope someone's there. But due to the U.S.'s speed and positioning, this didn't translate into anything. So no chances that high danger percentages were actually created.
Yeah, no. And I was looking at the PWHL leaders, and the top four are Americans. So, like, the states are good. We can't be too surprised that they lost. I think that I'm surprised with how Canada lost. Because, like you said, they did not look organized, honestly. Like, they didn't look like they really knew what was going on. Now, they are without their captain, Marie-Philippe Poulin, who got hurt against Czechia. So that's a big blow. But really, one player should not be meaning that your team cannot score a single goal.
Yeah.
Or get set up in the offensive zone. Yeah. So
I felt like I was watching Pee-wee hockey again, just dump and chase, but no actual, like, I mean, no disrespect to any of the players. Like, they are top level players. It's just the team organization that was really, really lacking in that moment. So I'm wondering if that's a coaching issue, or was the moment too big for some players?
Yeah.
Because I'm not sure the age distribution of that team. Is this a lot of people's first Olympics?
Yeah, I have no idea off the top of my head. But I do know that this was the one that they could lose.
Yeah.
Like, nice that they're playing the States in the group stage, because you get a good look at them. You know what they're going to come out like if you play them again, which I do think Canada will play the U.S. again. It's usually a given that that's the gold medal matchup in women's hockey. Obviously, things can change. Teams can get better. I know Sweden is looking okay this year, too. But Canada's got to figure something out before they go into the knockout stage, because this is not the way you want to play against a great American team.
Yeah, it's quite similar to how Canada's curling went.
Yeah.
Which was also another disappointment.
Yeah. No, the mixed doubles team did not have the best showing at the Winter Olympics this year. They were supposed to be one of the favorites. They were the top three favorite going in. And they started out hot. They won the first four games, I think, but then lost five games in a row. They lost to Estonia, Korea, Great Britain. And then they eventually beat Switzerland in a nothing game. Like, didn't matter. They won the last match, but they were not even competing for a bronze, which was disappointing, especially with curling being, like, one of Canada's sports that they excel the highest at, usually. Yeah. So, apparently there was, like, a lot of discrepancies over the ice quality and just getting used to the stones after they resurfaced them. Unfortunate, but the men's and women's curling tournaments are just about to start, over the next few days. So Canada could get some redemption there, which I do hope that we can see that. I want to pause just one moment and talk about this Norwegian biathlon athlete that just confessed to cheating, like, on his girlfriend on live TV. Crazy. Jack, did you see the video?
I did not see the video.
I have not seen the video.
Okay, so essentially this guy's getting interviewed. He just won a bronze medal in the biathlon, and he goes on a little bit of a tangent talking about how he cheated on his girlfriend, who he still loves very much, about 3 months ago, but he told her a week ago. She obviously cut things off.
Makes sense.
But he was saying that, like, this is his last ditch effort to, like, show the whole world that he's a bad guy and he messed up and that he wants her back super bad. So I think this just goes to show that all the lovely ladies in our lives are worth more than Olympic medals and Olympic fame. I think Jack and I can agree that we really love our girlfriends a lot. No, as well as AP.
I do.
Yeah. But it was just a funny moment. Like, you never know what you're going to get with the Olympics. like this is just outrageous
stuff.
And
you got to love that. Like, Norwegian, not humor, but they're very upfront with things. So
I mean, to all the ladies listening, would you take him back if he did that?
That's a great question.
That is a good question. Would you, if you get cheated on? They were only dating for 6 months too, and this happened halfway through, 3 months in.
Okay,
so
that's still fresh.
He took a pretty. I think this is a major red flag. Honestly, I don't like this guy. He was this seems like manipulative. You know,
I feel like 4 years. You know, back at the Olympics might do the same thing. Who knows? Yeah,
you never know. That's a good point. Exactly. The last thing we're going to talk about before we wrap up for today are just the lines that the men's team have been running in practice. Celebrini, McDavid, and Wilson is the first line. A lot of people were kind of stunned with Tom Wilson being up there, but you want to have a little bit of size. You want to have a little bit of ferocity.
Well, to add to that, like, I lived with a perennial Caps fan for 3 years of my university degree, and I began to see the upside of Wilson outside of his ferocity and size. He is actually a skillful player who can set things up. He has a lot of assists.
Yeah. No, so he'll be an asset to that line. Yeah. And just to conclude, the other lines are Marchand, MacKinnon, Suzuki, Stone, Crosby, Marner, Hagel, Horvat, and Reinhardt. And the defense was, as expected, Toews and Makar, Morrissey, Parayko, Harley, Doughty, Theodore, and Sanheim, with Binnington getting all of the first-team reps at goalie. So it'll be an interesting start. Canada plays Czechia in their first game. That is coming up in a few days. But it will be hopefully better luck than the women's tournament is going.